I think this actually gives us an opportunity to look a little more at what it means for something to be Lynchian.
We're going to dig into some evil. It's nice to have Doc Hayward to be like 100% Bob of it.
On this episode, I feel like a lot of the affairs and the secret romances really come into focus.
Sarah Palmer is split in two when the darkness reaches up for her daughter. It kind of marks her.
Hello and welcome to Back to the Double R, a podcast devoted to the seminal show Twin Peaks. My name is Damon.
Hi, I'm Jennifer.
Alan here.
My name is Jonathan, and we are going to be talking about the episode Traces to Nowhere. Before we really get going, it's important to have a discussion about sort of the titling and the numbering of the episodes, at least through the first two seasons of Twin Peaks. Television will have sort of production codes of how they do episodes. And if you look online, the production code for Traces to Nowhere is 1.001, or in other words, season one, episode one. Of course, there was the pilot beforehand. And in terms of this podcast, I'd like to think of each of these episodes as like chapters of a book, right? If we open the book, the first chapter is the pilot. The second chapter is Traces to Nowhere. So as we go along, we're going to call this episode two, even though online you may see this referred to as episode one or season one, episode one. The other thing to keep in mind is that none of the episodes were actually given titles by David Lynch or Mark Frost. When the show was brought to syndication over in Germany, whoever, you know, came up with the titling over there gave the episodes the titles. So when you look online and you see Traces to Nowhere or any of the other titles for the episodes, know that that comes from sort of an external thing. It comes from the German broadcasts. I do, however, think it makes it easy to discuss. So, you know, we're talking about Traces to Nowhere, episode two, in terms of here at Back to the Double R. Quick little recap for the episode here. It was originally broadcast on the ABC network on April 12th, 1990. And it picks up right the next day. Also important to note, generally, at least in the first two seasons, every episode of Twin Peaks takes place within a 24-hour period. So you're going to get essentially a day at a time as the show progresses. We open on Dale Cooper at the Great Northern. He's hanging upside down and, you know, dictating events to Diane, his sort of, you know, secretary there on the radio. We kind of follow Cooper throughout the day as he meets through various different residents of Twin Peaks. He first meets up with Audrey at the Great Northern. She flirts with him a little bit. Coop then goes to the sheriff's station and checks in with, you know, the sheriff and Lucy and Andy. They're all stuffing their faces with donuts and coffee. Doc Hayward brings them the autopsy results. He notes he couldn't do it himself. We check in with a lot of the other characters, like, you know, Shelley and Leo. It's established they kind of have a dysfunctional relationship, and we later find out that, you know, Leo commits a horrible act of violence against his wife. They talk to James Hurley, and they show video of Laura, where we finally first hear her voice and kind of see her personality before, you know, she was murdered. And then there's a lot of other sort of, I think, for lack of a better word, parent-child relationships in the show that we touch on here. Like, we see Donna talking to her mom about how she feels guilty about her relationship with James. You know, we see Big Ed talking with James and, hey, make sure he gets protected. We also see a conversation between Bobby and his parents. They get really kind of upset with him, you know, because he's smoking at the table. And the episode wraps up on a scene with Doc Jacoby, who we find has the other half of the locket that we saw at the end of the pilot episode. Oh, last thing, really important. There is a scene in the Palmer home where Sarah is talking to Donna, and Sarah sees a vision of a gray-haired, spooky-looking man. So let's go forward there with Traces to Nowhere. All right, so this episode was directed by Dwayne Dunham. He was the editor of the pilot episode, which is natural for him to kind of jump in and do the sort of directing duties here on this episode. Generally, the editor is almost going to be working side by side with directors. And I would say really even more so than a director, they're in control of how you know, an episode is paced instead of how the story gets told to the audience. They're really almost sort of the last people that have that control. So, you know, Dwayne Dunham, natural that he sort of takes the reins here. A couple of things that he's directly responsible for, like he was really cognizant of, you know, we need to make this a show, right? We can't kind of luxuriate and have it be a movie. Hey, we have a schedule. We need to have tension. And he really sort of, I think, puts that energy into this episode. Like it's his suggestion to kind of have Audrey and Cooper have their flirtation. From a technical standpoint, one of the other things that he does is he applies a coral filter to the photography. So when you watch Twin Peaks, you get sort of that, like it's almost like a creamy, sort of a dreamy look. And Lynch actually had to give ABC a note that says, yes, this is how we want the pilot to look. We don't want you guys to like go back and make any changes. This is the look that we're going for here. And like, I always think that's neat when TV does that sort of, like if you like remember really old school, like the Andy Kaufman special where he would, you know, he had like sort of the vertical hold messed with on purpose. Or like I remember, and this is spoilers for the end of The Sopranos, that show just cuts to black. And I remember watching it thinking like, what the hell is wrong with my TV? So it's nice that Lynch put that note in to tell ABC, nope, this is how we want the show to look. And I think that look really sort of contributes to the dreamy feel. Or I know, Colin, you sort of mentioned that Twin Peaks was like, you know, Brigadoon. I think that look of the show really helps it make it seem like it's almost like an otherworldly, dreamy sort of a setting. And really what Dunham is doing is he's sort of making a house style here.
I'm curious if that coral filter, if you've seen that used on other shows.
I mean, not really. And it's funny when you look at it on an HD TV now, this is a problem that they could have never anticipated 30 years ago when they filmed the show. But like, you'll see things like Kimmy Robertson's lipstick, like as Lucy, it almost shows up as like a neon red or like an orange. And like that wood paneling that is like really prevalent in this episode. Like it just looks like you're, you know, watching like it almost looks like you're watching it filmed in hot chocolate or something like that. It really gives it almost ethereal feel, but I can't think of anything else.
Well, there's a tradition in the old MGM melodramas that I think were filmed in Technicolor, and they were really heightened, sort of that heightened visual effect, kind of added to the emotional intensity. And this functions in the same way that you're describing. It sort of gives it that dreamy quality. I think that's right on.
Yeah, when you're mentioning like the old MGM stuff, I'm thinking of like almost like if you've seen like An American in Paris or any of the Vincente Minnelli musicals where, yeah, they really like mess with the filtering or mess with like, you know, the look of it. It's kind of really more of a film technique that they're bringing into TV versus, you know, your standard like shot on video television production.
I have to say, I really love the way all that wood paneling looks with that coral filter. Because it just, everything just feels so rich and warm. And, you know, thinking back to living in the Pacific Northwest and coming inside a space like that with a crackling fire and all that wood, all that, you know, wood paneling and coming in from like a cold, rainy day into a space like that, it makes it feel warm in the same way that experience actually felt.
I think there was some of that in the art direction for the pilot. I was struck by the majority of the wardrobe was in browns, very warm colors. And as we move into our discussion about this next episode, we're starting to see reds and greens. So that the whole art direction in general is interesting and important.
So I've been reading Reflections, an oral history of Twin Peaks by Brad Dukes. And in here, he mentions that the one color that they at least want to try to stay away from in terms of wardrobe or kind of highlighting too prevalently is blue. So that's something to watch out for when we're going forward. Just, you know, try to look if there's any blue popping up in places. Good clue to have, I think, while we're watching the show.
So it's interesting, we've already been talking about sort of some of the technical aspects of the second episode that are different from the pilot. And I want to take a moment here to talk about sort of the complicated nature of authorship in projects that are collaborative, like a television show. So in the popular vernacular today, people talk about things being Lynchian. And I feel like people who aren't even David Lynch fans sort of automatically know what that means, right? It's something that's kind of strange and off kilter, maybe a little spooky, maybe a little awkward, kind of doesn't make sense. And what's interesting to me about this episode is that we find the plot becoming more Lynchian as the sort of dark supernatural aspects of the story really start to ramp up here. I would say kind of primary among those is we get our first appearance of Bob, the spooky gray-haired man that John referred to earlier, who appears in a vision. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say he's going to become very important as the story moves forward. And, you know, with these sort of supernatural visions and this strange man who's appearing, you know, this is really, I think, what stamps this as sort of a Lynch project. But at the same time, as Jonathan mentioned, this episode is directed by Dwayne Dunham. And to me, it actually, even as the plot becomes more sort of Lynchian, the feel of the episode is much less Lynchy. We don't have the sort of awkward pauses in the dialogue that mark the pilot and a lot of David Lynch's other work. We don't get these long, ominous shots of inanimate objects. The editing is a lot tighter. It just feels a lot more like a traditional TV show. So what's interesting here to me is that I think this actually gives us an opportunity to look a little more at what it means for something to be Lynchian, right? Because what we see here is that that descriptor is actually a product of both the substance in the form of the plot, but also the style, right? So what we can see is that the plot becomes more Lynchy, the style becomes less Lynchy. And when we take David Lynch out of sort of one half of the equation, to me, it really displays how both of these pieces interact to create the unique form of storytelling that we associate with David Lynch. And so the question that I would put to you all is, you know, what do you see as sort of the really striking differences between episode two and the pilot? And is this still Lynchian, and why or why not?
I would love to first jump in and say that I'm finishing up some episodes of Riverdale right now. And last night I was watching an episode from spring 2020 that literally opens with a sign for the town of Riverdale. And the first words you hear are Jughead, a character, saying Lynchian, adjective to describe something inspired by the noted American filmmaker David Lynch, and or to describe something that is both incredibly macabre and incredibly mundane. And so the beginning of the episode is sort of like in a Lynchian style, like showing a small town and very Twin Peaksy. And throughout this podcast that all of us are doing, I feel like I'm going to continue to return to Riverdale a little bit to talk about how this TV show reflects a bit of a Lynchian influence. So it's funny that the show has an episode that's hyper aware of that and even calls it out. To me, you know, the Lynchian element of the episode of Riverdale has to do with kind of a creepy character showing up. And that to me is what is Lynchian about episode two, that we have Bob, Dr. Jacoby is kind of creepy. And then we also have a one-armed man appearing in a hallway. Like, all of that to me is pure Lynch.
I think, you know, one of the things that I like to keep in mind when I'm watching Twin Peaks is that it's not just David Lynch, and it's, you know, Mark Frost as well, right? In fact, if you look at the writing credits, you know, this episode is written by both Frost and Lynch. You know, so to me, like, the tension almost in the show is sort of the relationship sort of between the two creators, and, you know, maybe even on like another level, the relationship between, like, you know, these two guys who I think in their hearts want to be artists, right? Want to not have any sort of constraints or, you know, sort of rules or, you know, limiting issues versus, you know, the reality of, hey, we got to grind out a TV episode every week. But I think it does a good job of putting these little sort of quirky touches that Twin Peaks is known for. Like, you know, we see, you know, and I think Colin's going to touch more on this later, but how the first thing we see is Cooper is upside down, right? I don't think, you know, a normal show or a, you know, a traditional show is going to start with your, you know, main character completely inverted. And, you know, I like to, like, at the beginning where they're like stuffing their faces with donuts and they're almost trying to talk, like, while they're eating. Like, to me, that's classic Lynch, right? It's like, it's touching on some sound design. It's also, like, mm-hmm. a little bit funny. And you know, they pepper that stuff in, you know, throughout the episode where, you know, you get kind of a marriage between, you know, these two artists and the nature of, like, filming a TV show. And they really, and I think Dunham does sprinkles the stuff in throughout where, so we, you know, we get maybe the best of both worlds here.
I'm really glad you brought up Mark Frost here, actually, because I feel like his contribution to the show is almost always overshadowed by David Lynch in any discussion of this project, right? And, you know, it's telling that we don't have the term Frostian in our language in the same way we do with Lynchian, right? So it's interesting, right? Because it raises some questions about whether we can sort of tease out the contribution of Mark Frost and in what ways it's different from what David Lynch is bringing, right? What is Frost bringing to the show? And I mean, I know a lot of fans of the show have this belief that, you know, Lynch is kind of responsible for the weird stuff and Frost was like the straight man who brought the more like traditional television style to the program. But if you listen to interviews with David Lynch, he's actually dismissed that notion and said that, you know, a lot of people think that, but that's actually wrong, that, you know, they were both sort of bringing in a lot of unusual ideas to the program, right? And so, you know, it's almost too bad that we don't hear more from Frost about sort of what he brought, because I feel like we don't really know. And that's part of what allows Lynch to really sort of overshadow things.
Do you know, can you talk a bit, I don't know much about Mark Frost. Can you talk a bit about what his style is like as an auteur?
I can a little. Frost was like a TV guy, man. He was like a veteran writer on like shows like Hill Street Blues, which was kind of seen as like a really sort of progressive, like gritty real life cop show at the time. And I mean, he's just an old TV pro. One of the things I'm going to talk about too later on is his dad, Warren Frost, who plays Doc Hayward. And Doc Hayward, or I should say Warren Frost, like ran like a theater troupe in Minnesota. So he really has like a, you know, Mark Frost has got a really grounded sort of theater and TV background, right? He's, you know, he's an old pro at that sort of stuff. He's the, you know, whereas Lynch, I think, gets the respect because he had like Eraserhead, he had Blue Velvet. He even had a couple of failures like Dune, right? You know, under his belt to sort of mark him as, you know, like a big director, whereas like Frost has really just did a lot of grunt work in TV that just, you know, made him an old pro.
Yeah, so you can see why people would associate Mark Frost with the more sort of, you know, traditional television show aspects of the program. But again, you know, David Lynch has said that that's wrong. So that's interesting to me.
I love that we're talking about the word Lynchian, because it is like Hitchcockian, right? That's the other sort of adjective from visual cinema that shaped a lot of conversation about work, about influential directors who people tried to emulate, and people described, oh, this work is Lynchian. You know, they use that to talk about work that doesn't belong to the to the director. Exactly. Unless they say like, oh, this one isn't as Lynchian as something else. But I love that we're talking about this. I wanted to build on some of the thematic ideas that I was talking about last time. We had said in the pilot that we see surfaces and there's this emotion erupting from below into the open. Grace Zabriskie, for example, that emotional moment when she realizes that Laura has been murdered. That's a really iconic moment in the show, something that stuck with a lot of people. And I think that this is very much the fundamental unit of Lynch's art, or at least a lot of it. In the film, documentary film about David Lynch from a few years ago called The Art Life, we see that this idea of something bursting through a bucolic small town surface is actually part of his life story. He grew up in small towns. He had a couple of unusual incidents, including one echoing Ronette Pulaski walking in on the train tracks. And then he sort of had a dark urban side. He explored Washington, D.C., I think it was, when he was growing up in small town Virginia. And so this idea of two sides of this coin, this surface being breached, is something that he comes back to again and again. It's even in the paintings he does. If you see The Art Life, or if you see other paintings he's done, he actually does 3D paintings where things are bursting out of the canvas. I think it's even in the way he sort of holds himself. He's so smooth on the surface. It's interesting that he's so devoted to transcendental meditation. He seems to want to transcend those structures of emotion, and but he has, he has sort of what looks like a happy life, but there's this edge underneath. So in thinking about this idea of surfaces, especially vulnerable surfaces with reality lurking below, I think that's a structural way to see the show. We talked last time about the bucolic 50s, the dangerous 60s, and this sort of dark pivot from the 80s to the 90s. That's the structure of Twin Peaks, the town itself. There's a happy surface and there's dark stuff going on below. But it's not just that. Part of the reason it works so well is that there are people living at each level. There are surface dwellers and people from the underworld. And then there are characters who travel between the two, or who want to. So the Haywards are true surface people. Like you're saying, Jonathan, lawful good, just about as 50s as it gets, pure 50s. Bobby is trying to claw his way down from his father's very rigid world into the darkness. Audrey is trying to destroy something so that she can learn about the chaos below. And Sarah Palmer is sort of split in two when the darkness reaches up for her daughter. It kind of marks her. There is this friction point between the two domains. Laura disappears into this burned out train car, never comes out as a living person, but her image, her surface presence lives on and it's always there. The people in her life couldn't see below the surface. They kept saying, that's not Laura, that's impossible. But something came up from underneath and took her. And that's the story that Damon was talking about. There's something in the woods. And it's why Cooper and detectives in general are such powerful characters. As an agent, he's pure stereotype, but he has this vision that Sheriff Truman just doesn't have, right? Cooper comes literally from the Lamplighter Inn. He keeps talking about the Lamplighter. He's constantly looking and seeing He's interested in the Douglas firs and the snowshoe rabbits, and he can see points in the surface where the underneath has marked it. He sees the reflection of James' motorcycle in Laura's eye. He cracks open Laura's diary when everyone else is worried about where's the key. And he finds this letter under Laura's fingernail. He skims these surfaces to find claw marks from below. And of course, we know he'll be doing other kinds of seeing as the show goes on. So the episode ends with Sarah Palmer waking from a vision of the locket, screaming. She's been touched by this darkness and marked by it. And so it's this multi-layered structure. The city and the show are filled with characters either falling through holes down into the darkness or struggling to get back up to the light. It's really an incredible engine for tension. And as Jonathan noted, it's a great starting point for this episode, which begins with Cooper literally inverting himself to do his job. It's his discipline. He's a just the facts G-man, but he knows the underworld. So I would just be curious what you guys sort of think about this idea of the darkness marking the surface.
So something you sort of touched on is the mirrors, and I guess rather than saying something about it, I'm curious what other people think about the mirrors, because Colin, you mentioned that you're seeing things in reflection and some of the creepy elements in the episode, like the one-armed man we see in a mirror. And to me, that's a great device to kind of start revealing some of these things that we're just seeing fragments of, just starting to see fragments of this creepiness below.
Yeah, there are windows into the underworld. Our vision is distorted. That mirror where we see the one-armed man is one of those semi-spherical mirrors that distorts his vision. And then, of course, he enters into a dark blue room, which looks different than the hospital. Yeah, there's lots of little cracks in the surface of reality.
So a lot of people already know this, but I didn't know it till I found it on the internet, and then I had to go back and look to find it. But people think of this episode as the first time we see the scraggly haired man, Bob, but it's actually not. If you go back to the very end of the pilot, when Sarah Palmer is having her freak out, he can be seen in a very distorted way in the corner of the mirror behind her, right? So Bob actually shows up for the first time in a mirror too.
Really?
My understanding is that was an accident, and then they decided it was just too perfect and they left it in, right? But that's what Lynch does, right? Is he rolls with those accidents. So Bob is there because of an accident, and the whole reason that character was cast in the first place was because, you know, originally he was a stagehand and he was moving stuff around, and David Lynch saw him like behind the bars of the bed and thought this is too perfect, you know. And it's the same story with the Red Room, which we'll be visiting for the first time next episode. This was also not in the original script. It was just like something that came to Lynch all of a sudden and he decided to insert.
It's the perfect, like, you know, I mentioned the quote from Riverdale about Lynchian being, you know, having to do with the mundane and the macabre. So that's those two things together, the happy accident.
And I'll touch on some stuff real quick. One, mirrors are incredibly, incredibly, incredibly important in Twin Peaks going forward. So anytime you see a mirror, I would just say, pay attention. The show is trying to tell you something. I also think, you know, when we're having this conversation about like what's Lynchian, or if you want to, you know, people will use verbs like, or adjectives like Spielbergian or Kubrickian. And I think it's usually sort of like associated with, you know, directors that almost are imperious or have like a total like vision and control of like how they want something to be. Kubrick especially, right? The guy like notorious for take after take after take after take. You know, when you talk about Lynch, from everything you read from the actors, they say he's like unfailingly polite, like an incredibly like just, you know, gentlemanly, like, you know, like has a set where people feel welcome and warm, where there's a lot of collaboration. But I think what makes Lynch different than say Kubrick is that he, you know, he has room for accidents, right? Like in the, you know, the pilot, the, you know, the autopsy scene with the flashing lights, also an accident. So, you know, this is a guy who really is open to ideas and, you know, isn't beholden to like a script or something in his head. You know, he's okay with things being loose or, you know, incorporating the happy accident into the text of a show and having it be like a major, major part of how the plot is going to unfold.
That's interesting. In the art life, you get a lot of footage of him creating things and just sort of experimenting with, you know, pulling things out of the painting. And I think that's really something that he even managed to do on the set of a TV show, which is amazing. That's great insight.
All right, folks. One of the things that at least I, as a podcaster, want to touch on is every character in Twin Peaks. We're going to give a little bit of time just to, you know, kind of dive into them and talk about how we feel and have it lead into some other discussion. And so for Traces to Nowhere, for me, one of the characters I really want to jump in and talk about is Doc Hayward, played by Warren Frost, who, like I said, is Mark Frost's father, which is actually a fact that I didn't know. It should have seemed really obvious. You have two guys with the last name of Frost, but for whatever reason, didn't put two and two together until I did some research. I think Doc Hayward, like Pete, who we kind of focused on last episode, is one of those characters that is kind of static, right? And, you know, he's not going to be making, you know, huge changes. He doesn't go on big emotional journeys, but, you know, kind of in the same way that like Lynch used Jack Nance as sort of like almost like a security blanket moving into the world of TV. I think Mark Frost does the same thing with his father, right? He, you know, wrote the role for him. You know, he brings him in, and in the oral history, all the character, or, you know, all the actors basically say that, like, you know, Warren Frost was a bedrock, you know, that he was sort of a, you know, a guy that they really felt comfortable working scenes with, that they always knew what they were going to get. And I think there's a lot of comfort in that going forward. And like, you know, Colin was mentioning, you know, every character, I'm going to kind of do like the D&D alignment, and 100% Doc Hayward is lawful good, man. This guy, you know, he, you know, upholds, you know, like, I think a lot of goodness and purity. And, you know, you definitely see that at the beginning where he, and he's like, man, I couldn't even do the autopsy on Laura. I had to pass it off to someone else. And I also think there's things that they show in, you know, the pilot that really speak to the character of Doc Hayward. Like, I, you know, the scene where he's picking up Donna and he mentions to Donna that, hey, you got to put some air in your sister's bicycle tire. To me, that's almost like a Lynchian detail, because, like, what really does that add to the narrative? It's not like plot driven. It doesn't have anything to do with like solving, you know, the mystery of who killed Laura Palmer. But I think they deliberately put that in there because they want you to have characters that, you know, are going to be good, especially in a character, like in a show where we're going to, you know, dig into some evil, or we're going to dig into a lot of like moral ambiguity. It's nice to have Doc Hayward to be like the guy. No, you know, he is 100% lawful good. We can count on him to be on our side. And I think too, it doesn't get enough credit, this show, you know, where it shows like true heroism. I think a lot of times people are drawn to the sort of the anti-heroes, the ambiguity, or, you know, the truly evil characters are a lot of fun, but it's hard to be, I think, to portray like true goodness on TV or in a book or anything. And I just kind of want to know what you guys feel about the portrayal of either Doc Hayward or any other sort of, you know, of our lawful good or our true hero characters here. Like, you know, how do you guys feel about what Twin Peaks is doing with those types of characters?
I think a lot of the work that those lawful good characters do is to set up the counterpoint. Like, you can't have the darkness without the light, and you can't have the, you know, those really scary figures without, you know, sort of a rock, a center. And I feel like on the page, maybe Doc Hayward and the Haywards in general were sketched out as, here's this perfect 1950s family. But I think you're right. The performance, especially of Warren Frost, brings a humanity to it. And so it's more resonant than it might have been. It's not just a cookie cutter. He really does make you feel that. And that's an accomplishment.
He's so warm and genuine, you know?
It's nice because you really get that he like loves his daughter. And I mean, you kind of don't really see a lot of positive portrayals of like fatherhood on TV a lot of times, I don't think. So it's nice, even though it's brief, that you get it in there, right? That, you know that like, okay, you know, this guy's going to not let us down.
Yeah, I'm gonna talk later about dysfunction and some of the bad relationships that you have on the show. So I think, like Colin said, it's nice to have this counterpoint of, well, and also to Colin's point about the surfaces, you know, we know that there's always this evil and layers and things are lurking, you know, beneath this tranquil seeming town. But maybe there are some people that what you see is what you get and they are good. So yeah, I think you do need that counterpoint when you have all this scariness happening too.
And, you know, one of the other things that I was struck, especially in terms of like looking at like, you know, sort of a relationship between parents and children, is that Traces of Nowhere, I think, really kind of hits a lot of those bases and shows you a lot of different various types of relationships. I mean, because you have, you know, not only Doc Hayward and, you know, Donna from the previous episode, but you get, you know, Mary Jo Deschanel, who is Eileen, you know, her mom, and her and Donna have that really nice conversation. Also, for you trivia heads out there, she's the mother of Zoe Deschanel and Emily Jo Deschanel, who were, I think, what, New Girl and Bones. So, and her husband is a director on a few episodes of the show. So, you know, they keep it in family. Like you see, you know, Big Ed and James, you see Bobby and his family. And even I think you get kind of like almost parenting with stuff that people aren't exactly parents. Like there's, I know they're trying to play up like a romance between Cooper and Audrey, but I think he definitely sees it more of like, you know, he's more mature and maybe she's a little bit less so. Or you get like Shelley and Norma. It's really good to look at them because you never see Shelley's parents in the show. So in a lot of ways, like Norma is her surrogate mother. What do you guys think about any of the other like relationships that we see between parents and children in the show?
Well, one thing, you know, I'm going to be thinking a lot about teenagers and how teenagers are portrayed. And definitely in this episode, you see some of the rebel teen stuff going on between the parents and the kids, like Bobby Briggs, you know, his dad at this dinner in their house, his dad is sort of laying down the law and slaps Bobby. So, and has this whole kind of discussion with him about rebellion too, which I think is really interesting that they're explicitly having a conversation about teen rebellion. And we see some of that with Audrey and her dad too, where Audrey is just like poking the bear always.
Oh yeah.
That conversation between Bobby and his dad, or really that is his dad's monologue there, so amazing because he's so respectful, he's so attentive and caring and reasonable, but Bobby is just trying to set the world on fire, and the tension between them mm-hmm. breaks their bond, it breaks whatever might have been between them. He, you know, Bobby so wants to get to the underworld that the care and concern, the loving embrace of a caring square father just completely flummoxes him. He can't even believe what he's saying.
It's so weird though, because his dad is almost like out of an educational yes. film in his monologue. It's very much like, uh-huh. like this is what teen rebellion is. And I understand teen rebellion, but I need you to conform to that's these right. societal that's expectations. Right. And then he slaps him, you know? So that warmth of his dad is there, but it's sort of strange because it's in this kind of military, I mean, another kind of 50s feeling vibe yeah. at that meal.
Yeah. You know, the relationship between Bobby and Garland Briggs, played by Dana Ashbrook and the late Don S. Davis, it's definitely important for how sort of the rest of the show going forward, at least that particular relationship is. And, you know, I think, you know, like, again, you know, Garland in his own way is trying to display like, you know, compassionate parenting, like, hey, I understand your need for rebellion, you know, and like he, you know, he doesn't want to tell Bobby really who to be or like, you know, how it is, but there is sort of that like pull of like, but no, like I can't have you smoking at my dinner table and I can't have you like ending up in a jail cell.
We're going to make your path very clear.
Yeah. But it's wonderful, right? Because it, you know, cause I think sometimes it's a lot how parents are. I mean, I myself am one, and you're like, man, I want my kid to like, you know, kind of find out who their own person is. But at the same time, you're just like, no, we got rules here.
But he says it all out loud, right? He says out loud what I think a lot of parents just think.
I definitely think too, it's worth watching Audrey and Ben. Again, that's another one that is going to have a lot of like twists and turns and like different types of payoffs. And, you know, I think Audrey's character too, for me, like I'm, you know, if I had to pick one character that I kind of feel like most like in my own life, it is Audrey, in the sense that like, she seems to be the only character that expresses a true desire to like want to leave or like maybe like, you know, go somewhere else. And, you know, her father just doesn't even really seem to care or like, you know, notice her at all. So when we see Sherilyn Fenn and, you know, Richard Bammer, those are all gold scenes too. And well worth noting as we kind of continue our journey in the show.
She is always trying to be noticed. And I have to say, one of my favorite moments of the pilot is when she sticks the pencil through the styrofoam cup and you watch as, you know, it starts to create its, you know, havoc on, you know, as the liquid comes out of it. It's just, that's perfect Audrey.
and like, she totally doesn't care. Like, oh, my classmate just died. And she don't care one bit about like disrupting his business meeting. Like, she's like, nope, you're going to pay attention to me and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to like, you know, make sure your focus is on me.
I feel like she's using these acts of destruction as like a way to get into a darker world. You know, it's how her version of what Bobby is doing. And it's related, but not exactly the same. Like, she hungers for the sensuality that is sort of out of reach. And so she's going to destroy things to see if she can get through to that other place.
Did anyone else pick up on, at the beginning of the episode, Agent Cooper has just like these seemingly throwaway lines about Marilyn Monroe and JFK. And then later Audrey walks in a very Marilyn Monroe type manner, you know,
it's 100% there. Absolutely.
And Agent Cooper is like ogling her. It just made me think there's, you know, this a Marilyn aspect to her.
For sure. And one thing I'll say about Audrey before we move on, kind of totally unrelated, like you can totally tell that like they filmed this like way after the pilot, because the episode is supposed to be the next day, but her hair is like very
different. Her hair is totally different. Yeah.
You know, so it's just one of those things when you're watching the show, especially if you watch it a lot of times, you're like, wait, this is supposed to be the next day, right? Well, clearly they filmed it sometime, you know, between the two things, which is another way you can totally tell, oh, we're in TV show land now and not movie land.
So I really want to talk about how this is the first episode where we actually hear from Laura Palmer. So we see her, like I mentioned in the pilot, you know, she's haunting everything. She's the dead body that's at the center of this murder mystery. So we see more of her in this episode, but we start to hear from her. And the sounds that we hear from her are all in the context of relationships. So James Hurley, played by James Marshall, has a flashback, and we see Laura in his memory flashback and hear her voice. And it's this lovey dovey, sweet sounding voice where she gives him half of her heart. And so that's, I believe, the first time we hear her. And then at the end of the episode, Dr. Jacoby pops in this cassette tape that Laura has sent him. And so he listens to Laura Palmer on this cassette and he lets us listen. He has his headphones off of his ear so the audience can hear Laura. And by the end, he puts the headphones back on his ear so we actually don't hear the rest of the cassette. But we hear this very different Laura in this cassette where she's, you know, sort of like, hi. And it's a much more, you know, I'm thinking back to Colin talking about the surfaces, and we're seeing these two, we're hearing these two sides of Laura, the lovey-dovey, you know, sweet girl, you know, in this relationship with James, and then this person who has this secret relationship with Dr. Jacoby, who seems creepy. He's got, you know, his Hawaiian shirt on in this strange, like, bachelor pad type setting. And he, you know, I like to think about these connections between TV and movies past and present. So Dr. Jacoby, played by Russ Tamblyn, he was in the film Peyton Place, which was, you know, this sudsy, you know, soap opera book and film and TV show. He was also in High School Confidential and West Side Story. So he has like this teen, you know, rebel backstory. And now he's this older sort of creepy guy having this, you know, we don't know yet what kind of relationship he has with Laura, but it's secret. So we hear part of that where Laura sounds totally different and darker. And she talks about, in the tape, Laura talks about being bored with James, that, you know, he's sweet, but he's dumb. And she expresses this fear that she's going to get lost in the woods again, and mentions a mystery man. So more of these layers get revealed that people think they knew Laura, but they didn't. And there's this whole other relationship that none of us seem to know about was with Dr. Jacoby. And so this is what we have with a voice, her voice being revealed in this episode. But then we also have some other visions of her. Laura appears as a ghost to her mother while her mother is talking to Donna. And, you know, so Laura's mother is staring at Donna, and all of a sudden Laura's face appears in Donna's face. And then the autopsy photo that we see throughout the episode is a bit different this time, where it's just Laura's face circled by the plastic, almost like a head on a platter. It's very, very strange and creepy. So it's less the body and more just the face. So Laura, again, haunting the episode is something that remains with me. And I'm curious what others of you think about that and your relationship to seeing Laura and hearing from Laura for the first time.
I think that's so interesting to tease that out. And there is one other moment where we hear her voice, and it's a tiny little snippet where we see this weird, it's a flashback, but it's a flashback to the video, and we don't know who's seeing it. It's for the audience. Maybe it's Cooper's inner psyche or something, but we just see her smile frozen, and we hear her say, "Help me," but it's in this downward pitched voice, so it slows down, it's lower than that dewy soap opera flashback with James. It's the opposite, it's the same thing. It's sound cues, you know, she sounds like she's at the bottom of a well, or, you know, in this underworld, and she's saying, "Help me."
Yeah, that is so, I remember hearing that and not even knowing where to place it. You know, is it, who's hearing it? Whose memory? But that's a really great addition to kind of thinking about how we hear her this time around.
Right. And it's totally different from her voice in either of the other two instances in the episode, right? This is like a much more like vulnerable and frightened person that we're hearing, even in just that snippet.
And so I also want to talk a little bit about romance and dysfunction, and Laura obviously is the center of that as well, as we will learn. But on this episode, I feel like a lot of the affairs and the secret romances really come into focus. And so several are revealed or acknowledged in this episode. And we find out that some of these affairs are open secrets. So, and we see the dark side of some of them. So just, you know, quickly, some of the things we notice are Cooper picks up on Harry and Josie having a romance. And he says, "Oh, I just noticed your body language." Donna reveals to her mother, not only that Laura and James had a secret relationship, but now that Donna and James are falling in love. And then Donna's boyfriend, Mike, around the same time, he picks up that his girlfriend is cheating on him. And then we see this, you know, sizzling shots of a secret affair between Catherine Martell and Benjamin Horn, that they are not only having an affair, but they're also in cahoots in this business scheme. And then...
And have been for a long time, right? Both it having an affair and...
Yeah, and they start and they kind of like reveal that. And then... The sheriff acknowledges the Ed and Norma affair. And, you know, we saw them at the Roadhouse in the pilot. So it seems that some of these affairs are happening in the open in places like the Roadhouse. And then Ed's wife, Nadine, bumps into Norma in a scene where you think maybe she's about to confront her about the affair. But it's just this weird, banal conversation about curtains.
Very Lynchian.
Yeah. And then obviously the Jacoby relationship with Laura. So it's kind of like overwhelming. Like, to me, this is very soapy that all of a sudden, like, everybody seems to be having an affair. And then on the dark side, we see this horrible, situation that Shelley is in with her husband, Leo. And you start to realize maybe why she is stepping out with Bobby Briggs, who, you know, may not be the finest catch either, but Leo is physically abusing Shelley, and we see that in a really awful scene. So, you know, for all of you, like, what do you think about all these relationships that we're seeing? Why are there so many affairs?
Well, I'll go first if we don't mind. I grew up in a small town. I don't know where y'all grew up in, but I grew up in Kingston, Washington, which, you know, more or less is pretty much the same size as Twin Peaks, minus like a really fancy hotel. And, you know, one of the reasons that I no longer live in Kingston, Washington, is that towns, for lack of a better word, become inbred, and not like literally like family members, you know, doing some, that sort of stuff. But, you know, you see the same people every day, and you've seen them since you've gone to like kindergarten together. Right. And, you know, you're, the worldview is limited, you know, it's just, you know, the town and the surrounding area. So you get, you know, it's like, hey, you know, I've had the affair, or like, oh no, I know that like I had like the secret torch for, you know, this person back in high school, but circumstances where I ended up with someone else. And some of those things like never leave, you know. And for a show where I think sometimes they're not aiming for truth or, you know, verisimilitude, I think Frost and Lynch nail that here, in the sense that, you know, these people aren't going really outside of their own bubble. And of course, like, humans get bored, man. You know, so they're gonna, you know, like screw around or scheme together. So I think it's really more of a nod to just the fact that like this type of behavior happens in small towns everywhere. It's very familiar.
I think part of what's going on too is this, in the classical kind of storytelling that Lynch draws from, the lure of sensual pleasure is sort of ever present. It's part of the human condition, you know. At the very top of this sort of scale of goodness, we have the, you know, we have the Haywards, you know, a happy home, but it's completely desexualized in the way it's portrayed. And people are sort of caught in the 50s, and many of them are trying to get out, and some of them are, you know, looking for true love. And some people, like Audrey, that leads her down a very dark path. Some people, like Norma, she becomes self-sacrificing and sort of says, oh, you know, Ed and I can never really be together. And so, you know, it's, everybody has a tension around whether they will get to be full humans, you know, and really have pleasure and love.
Well, and the 50s is all about repression, right? I mean, it's all about repression of the sensual, right? I mean, that's just a huge part of sort of the character of that era that, you know, we know Lynch was really steeped in. And I would point out, and I think you kind of gestured towards this, Colin, that this is really a common theme in his work overall, right? I mean, you look at like Lost Highway or Eraserhead, you know, the kind of repression of the sensual and then sort of bursting out through infidelity is something that we see as a repeated theme in his work.
I'll touch on a performance aspect of this really quick. When we watch Peggy Lipton as Norma, and also to a certain extent, Wendy Roby as Nadine, but especially Peggy Lipton, like everything you need to know about what's going on in the interior of her character, she conveys through like her eyes and her facial expressions. Like, and it's never, I mean, sometimes like people really do make things explicit. Like, you know, Don Davis as Garland Briggs talking to Bobby, like Norma never says the quiet part out loud. It's always like kept inside. So when you watch her, like, I mean, she's just masterclass of like eyes and facial expressions and just, you know, simmering, boiling stuff that she pretty much never lets out. And she's fantastic throughout the series. And, you know, just, you know, every time someone comes into the double R or you see Norma, just, you know, watch her eyes, right? Because they're always telling the truth.
So for me, one of the most horrifying moments in the episode is the scene where Leo prepares to abuse Shelley, and we don't see it. We just see the preparation for that. And I just thought we should talk about that a little bit, about how that fits into the rest of the episode and how you see violence in this episode as well.
It's incredibly brutal and incredibly hard to watch. And he does, the director, the production does that thing of letting us imagine it, not showing us, which can make it worse. Though, you know, throughout this episode, he's abusing her psychologically. Mm-hmm. He's grabbing her cheek and, you know, treating her literally like an object. And in the same way that Lynch tries to break down this perfect image of the 50s, part of what comes through is reality. And this is a reality. And so many of the women in Twin Peaks are on the receiving end of terrible relationships. On the one hand, it's sort of a stereotype from melodrama and soap operas, but he's also doing the work of showing, no, this gets as bad as you can imagine. And that almost felt to me like, yes, we're in a narrative, we're in a show, and we're going to have supernatural monsters. And don't forget, in the reality that we all live in, there is real evil and real monsters are among us too.
It's terrifying that in Shelley's case, it's intertwined with the affair she's having with Bobby too, because Bobby is in shady business dealings with Leo, with her husband. And so is it an escape to have this affair with Bobby, who's also in cahoots with her husband? It adds to just the feelings of unease about this whole horrible relationship, and you know, nothing good can come of any of this.
Like, it's a hard scene for a lot of reasons. I mean, one, just, you know, the violence and the nature of it, and I also think too that man, like, I know so many guys who are just like Leo Johnson, and I mean, not necessarily like putting a bar of soap in a sock and beating the crap out of somebody, but you know, just like, for lack of a better word, losers, right? Who, you know, have never ever like left their small town, probably don't have a lot of education, you know, don't have really like job prospects. So what do, right? And they take out their sort of, you know, pissed off at life feelings on something that's innocent and pure. Or, oh, well, you know, I can't control how much I've been screwed over by life, but I can, you know, beat the crap out of my wife, right? I can, you know, be horrible to like someone else. And I mean, it's tough because I think in certain ways, like, this show wants you to almost not sympathize, but at least sort of understand the mindset of someone like Leo Johnson, which is a really sort of scary and uncomfortable place to be. You know, but it but it also is just like, no, this is like horrible and terrible, you know? So it's always hard watching that stuff. Cause it's just like, man, like, you know, I know people like that from, you know, just growing up. And like, I know kind of like how that small town, like mindset can create a monster like that. Right. Where you're just like, you know, we're devoid of like, you know, education or prospects. And I don't have like the self-reliance, to, like, you know, better myself. So yeah, I'm just going to turn to, you know, things that I can't control, which is, you know, being a jerk or taking it out on someone or, you know, giving over to a life of crime.
Yeah. I mean, and this is like the real monster that lurks in small town America. Right. And, you know, Leo is in many ways, the grossest character in this show, right? He's in many ways, he's creepier even than a lot of the supernatural, characters that we'll spend more time with down the road. I mean, he lives in this like weird unfinished house with like plastic walls, and like is this, you know, long haul truck driver who, you know, clearly is using his job as a means of trafficking drugs, which he seems to be, you know, partaking of himself. And he's just like, he's like John said, he's this like stuck, frustrated man who has got who is just exercising power where he feels like he can, right? And you know, I don't this isn't what this podcast is about, but this is something that we've seen in a really prominent way in American politics over the last several
totally
years
agree.
Too, right? Is,
totally agree.
Is this angry dead end man who lashes out to feel powerful.
So I just want to talk a bit about food and coffee in this episode. So we have a fish and a percolator. We have people stuffing their faces with food and then talking and gulping uncomfortably, you know, while their mouths are full of pastries. And like we've mentioned, like some of these scenes are sort of Lynchian and odd. Like you wouldn't see some of these in a normal TV show. But, you know, what is it all about? Why are the pastries and the pie and the cigarette and the dinner? What is this obsession with food and coffee?
There's something really fun going on with Cooper that you don't necessarily notice. And it comes up twice, at least twice in this episode when he is ordering breakfast at the Timber Room. He orders his bacon. He says, super crispy, almost burned, cremated. And he could have stopped, you know, a normal TV show, normal script would have stopped with almost burned. But he is comfortable going all the way to something truly dark. And when Pete is pouring him coffee, Pete asks, how do you take it? And Cooper says, black as midnight on a moonless night. Pete says, pretty black. So there's this thing, right? Like Cooper is such a ramrod straight kind of guy, but he traffics in true darkness.
Like it might almost be a way because, you know, I remember like there's a throwaway line in the pilot too, where Coop and Truman are just like sitting in the patrol car and it just cuts to Coop where he's like, give me a donut. You know, and I wonder if like the food is sort of meant to be like, you know, because we see Cooper and like, you're like, man, this guy must be in shape if he can, first of all, like do that sit up that like gets him to like, you know, get inverted like that. So I wonder if like, you know, having the coffee that's as black as night or like donuts with their, which are really just not great for you. It's bad for you. Right. But they taste wonderful. So I wonder if like, these are like maybe it's sort of the little sins that he allows himself or
he's going to have like three pieces of pie. He had one piece of pie and he ordered two more. And I think there's even a comment about his metabolism after that. Like, you know.
Yeah. Well, and he says he knows he's not supposed to eat eggs but, you know, old habits die hard.
Yes. I wonder if it's just really more like, I mean, you know, the food, I think, is part of the fun of the show, right? Because everyone always thinks of like, oh, like, you know, get you the cup of Joe and, you know, get you the pie and all that stuff. So I think on one level, it's kind of like there's your quirk, but I think it's also definitely maybe saying something to like sort of the emotional state of the characters, or like, you know, hey, if like Cooper has to put on like the agent face, like almost every other time, like, you know, these are sort of like these indulgences that he's allowing himself.
Well, that's his, right. That's his sensual pleasure in the daytime, you know, in the surface world. He has cremated bacon and coffee black as night, but he's very chipper about it. You know, and he loves his pie so much, and the Lamplighter Inn, the lunch at the Lamplighter Inn. These are, you know, these are sort of the little sensual moments that he allows himself in order to stay disciplined when he does his job.
And these are, you know, we're talking about this at the end, but these are real hallmarks of the show. And you know, oftentimes when people think about Twin Peaks, they think about pie, they think about coffee. And so that is, it's part of the whole story of the show is food.
I mean, I think, you know, Lynch himself has kind of a thing about food too. And I can't quite put a finger on exactly what it is, but the whole time we've been talking about this, I've been thinking about that video that he put out a few years ago where he explains how he makes quinoa. And it's like 20 minutes of David Lynch making quinoa and eating it on camera. And he definitely has a thing about coffee. I mean, I think for a while there was even like a David Lynch signature blend you could buy, right? So some of this, I think, just comes from his own personal quirks.
This reminds me too, something we had talked about. He went to the same diner in Hollywood. Went to the Bob's Big Boy every day. Bob.
Well, no, that's why it's called, it's why it's Bob, because it's a nod to Bob's Big Boy.
He went there every day and had a chocolate milkshake, I think it was, at least had a milkshake, and did his work, did that every day for 7 years. And, you know, as part of it, he's sort of like Cooper in that he has his disciplines that allow him to, you know, do this spooky work, because his regular world is very ordered, and so he can go farther.
Well, and I'm reading his biography/autobiography Room to Dream right now, and I just finished up the chapters about while he was in art school, and he actually talks pretty extensively about the diner that he would go hang out in when he was in art school, that was, you know, nearby where he lived. And so, I mean, diners clearly are just like, and it comes back to this 50s thing, right? Where the diner is such a central location in 1950s stories, and they clearly loom large in his imagination.
Yeah, too. I feel like we're going to talk more about diners in the episodes to come. How could we not?
Well, I think we certainly will have to, and Damon and I will have to at least nod to the trip we took a couple of years ago to Tweety's Diner in Eastern Washington, the site of the original Double R.
Yeah, there's a line, it's later, like a couple episodes down the road, but it's like they said this is where, you know, like pies have died and gone to heaven. I've tried the pie. It's 100% true.
Well, that seems like a good place to leave this for the week. Thanks everyone for joining us again. Music as always by Silencio, and we hope you'll join us again next week for episode 3 of Twin Peaks on Back to the Double R.